The following program is brought to you by your friends at Podcast One. Don't forget to download our new Podcast One app.
Zola takes the stress out of wedding planning with free wedding websites, your dream wedding registry, affordable save the dates and invitations, and easy-to-use planning tools. To start your free wedding website and also get $50 off your registry on Zola, go to zola.com/coldcase. Start with a free wedding website. It's so easy, and it just takes minutes to set up. With over 100 beautiful wedding website designs to choose from that fit any couple's style and every type of wedding. You can even add your Zola wedding registry right to your website. Plus, guests love free shipping and returns, price matching, and more. Zola makes it easy to personalize your favorite design with all your wedding details. Add photos, stories about how you two met, travel and accommodations info, and even recommend things to do for your guests while they're in town for your wedding. To start your free wedding website and also get $50 off your registry on Zola, that's Z-O-L-A, go to zola.com/coldcase. On December 15th, 1978, 11-year-old Billy Hewling hid trembling in his bedroom. He could hear gunshots and the screams of his family. A stranger had entered his home in Stearns County, Minnesota, and began to execute members of the Hewling family. Billy waited. He waited huddled in a sleeping bag on his bed. The stranger shot the sleeping bag twice. Billy wasn't hit by the bullets, but he stayed under the covers until the man left. When the noises stopped, Billy ran down the stairs and escaped the house. He kept running as fast as he could through the dark, freezing woods, searching for help. From A&E, this is Cold Case Files. Billy was able to find help, and Jim Kostreba, the sheriff of Stearns County, responded to the call. He quickly made his way to the house where Billy's family was attacked. This is Sheriff Kostreba.
As soon as I opened the door into the porch and stepped in, I could immediately smell the smell of gunpowder. And with my flashlight, I was able to see a 12-gauge shotgun casing laying on the floor.
The sheriff then made his way to Alice's room, Billy's mother. Alice occupied the only bedroom on the first floor of the home. She was 36.
I saw her laying on the bed, and she was laying with her head towards the foot of the bed with her legs drawn up, and I, just by observing her, I realized that she was dead.
Following a trail of empty shell casings, Kostreba made his way up the stairs to check the other rooms. Here's Sheriff Kostreba again.
When I got to the top of the steps, I could see that there was a lot of blood and tissue and hair splattered against the wall, the far wall.
Upstairs, the sheriff discovered that three of the Hewling children had been murdered. 16-year-old Susie, 13-year-old Wayne, and 12-year-old Patty. He moved to 11-year-old Billy's room, the youngest Hewling, the one who had run for help.
The sleeping bag was laying on that bed, and you could see two gunshot holes actually in the mattress and the pillow. And Billy had said that the guy had shot twice at him and had missed both times because he had kind of slid down inside a sleeping bag.
Like in many rural communities, crimes of this magnitude were extremely uncommon, causing a huge impact on the lives of the small town residents and the sheriff's office.
By Patty's bed, there was a dresser. On that dresser, there was a stack of clothing. And obviously what she had done is she had gotten her clothes out the night before she went to bed. And I had placed them there to get put on in the morning. And I knew that that's what she was going to do. She had plans to get up in the morning and go to school, get dressed and go to school, and it didn't happen. And she didn't have a chance. The only chance she had was to cover up her head before she got shot. And I guess that's something that'll be with me the rest of my life.
As morning came, a team of investigators arrived to process the scene and look for clues. They searched the house and only found empty shell casings, They followed tracks in the snow, but none of them led to the killer. On December 19th, 4 days after the Hewling family was executed, Deputy Gary Miller was on patrol in neighboring Wright County. He received a routine call. A customer was harassing his server at the Clearwater Plaza truck stop. Before confronting the disruptive customer, Miller ran the man's license plates. This is Deputy Miller.
And I ran the tag, the license number, to try to get a little background on who I was going to be dealing with. When that license check came back, it indicated the vehicle was a stolen.
Detective Miller approached Joe Turry, the problem patron, and he arrested him for car theft. This is Detective Miller again.
The vehicle that he was driving was towed into our impound area there. And as was our procedure, I asked another officer to accompany me, and we did an inventory of the car. There was a number of notebooks and coasters and napkins that had names of females and license numbers of cars, and some of them had descriptions of where they live. A couple of them had been circled, said, "Get this one."
Many of the women on the list in Turry's notebooks were waitresses. Gary Miller, like all law enforcement personnel in the area, knew the details of the Hewling family murders. He thought that his fascination with waitresses could possibly be a link between Turry and the Hewlings. Susie Hewling, who was 16 on the night her family was killed, had a job waiting tables at a local diner. Here are some of the audio from an interview with Turry about his notebook.
Let's see, one other item we laid out there, a little brown diary, names and addresses and stuff in them. Is that yours?
What has that got to do with anything?
Well, that's what I'm asking you.
Maybe the most solemn, 10 most wanted guy.
No. No, then I'm just trying to find out if this little diary, if that was yours or if it was in the car when you took the car or...
What has it got to do with anything?
Well, maybe nothing.
It doesn't.
In other words, it's yours, isn't it?
Yeah, it's mine.
While owning and maintaining a detailed list of women is unusual and extremely creepy, it's not against the law. But the potential connection to the Hewling murders was enough to get Sheriff Kostreba involved. Remember, he was the officer who responded when Billy ran for help. Here's Sheriff Kostreba's description of the suspect.
He was kind of a drifter. He wasn't able to hold a job very long. And since he really didn't have a place to live, he spent a lot of time in restaurants and truck stops and those sorts of places. And he said that he was trying to find a girlfriend. And so he would write down descriptions of potential girlfriends.
The detectives found another item in the stolen car that was at the least a bit unusual. It was a 27-inch metal rod wrapped in black vinyl. The metal rod was another potential link between Turry and the murders of Billy's family. Here's Sheriff Kostreba to explain.
Well, we knew that Alice had sustained some beating, and we always thought that bar was a possibility, but when they weren't able to find any blood or tissue on it, then it was kind of put aside.
The investigators couldn't find a direct link between Turry and the murders. To make matters worse, 3 weeks later, the auto theft charge was cleared, and their only suspect was gone. May 9th, 1979, in Afton, Minnesota, 5 months after the Hewling family was killed and 95 miles away from their home, Fran Wollenhaus was having a normal day. By mid-afternoon, Fran had finished her errands and headed home. Fran lived with her daughter, 18-year-old Marlis, who was set to graduate high school at the end of the month. She also had a part-time job. Marlis was a waitress. Here's Fran Wollenhaus.
So I drove in the driveway, which was a long driveway, and I saw Marlis's car. I opened the door to the lower level on the side of the house, and I called Marcy, and she didn't answer.
Fran went inside feeling concerned. When she entered the study, she saw Marlis. Here's Fran again.
She was sitting upright against the little school desk that I had when I was in third grade. And she was totally covered in blood. And all I did was hold her to me until the police came. I mean, there was no, I saw the injury and knew, I mean, her brain skull was totally crushed and was on the floor.
Marlis died 2 days later in the hospital. Commander Mike Johnson was a member of the team assigned to investigate the teenager's murder. This is Commander Johnson.
There were a number of investigators that were assigned initially. Probably two-thirds of what then was our investigative division worked the case in the early weeks. But it was quickly evident that there was not going to be a quick resolution to this case.
Investigators didn't have much to go on. Sadly, without a murder weapon, fingerprints, or any other clues, the case quickly went cold. On Saturday, May 12th, the day before Mother's Day, Fran Wollenhaus buried her daughter. This is Fran.
Of course, I was totally in shock, numb, had no feelings. And Mother's Day from then on for many years were extremely painful. And I wanted to know in my lifetime who did it and why. I wanted answers.
You know what's smart? Kicking off 2019 by planning out which roles your business needs to hire for. You know what else is smart? Starting the new year off strong by going to ZipRecruiter.com/coldcase to hire the right people. Unlike any other job sites, ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates for you. Its powerful matching technology scans thousands of resumes to identify people with the right skills, education, and experience, and it actively invites them to apply to your job, so you get qualified candidates fast. That's why ZipRecruiter is rated number one by employers in the U.S. This rating comes from the hiring sites on Trustpilot with over 1,000 reviews. And right now, our listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/coldcase. If you love this show, show your support to it and ZipRecruiter by going to ZipRecruiter.com/coldcase, C-O-L-D-C-A-S-E. That's ZipRecruiter.com/coldcase. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
I'm going to visit my family in Florida this summer, and while I'm there, I want to find something great to do with my children and my nieces and nephews. On Viator, I found an incredible excursion that I am so excited to go on, an electric trike tour around the town. How fun does that sound? If you're looking for things to do this summer, Viator is a tool you can use to plan and book travel experiences around the world. The Viator app and website make it easy to explore 300,000 plus travel experiences so you can discover what's out there no matter where you're traveling or what you're interested in. Viator can help you plan better travel experiences. There are real traveler reviews to get insider information from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering. Plus, Viator offers 24/7 customer service, so you know you'll get support at any hour if things aren't going as planned. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find the perfect travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Saving money on your entire roofing project now at Menards. Protect your home for years to come with Owens Corning architectural shingles. They offer long-lasting performance while providing ultimate protection with a 130 miles per hour wind rating and limited lifetime warranty. Choose from over 50 options of Owens Corning shingles in-store and on Menards.com. And check out more of our great deals going on now.
Save big money at Menards.
If you're navigating through Hollywood, let Todd Garner be your guide.
Everybody should get a Todd Garner.
The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner. Recent guests include Kevin James.
You were born in Long Island.
And is it really an island?
It's three sides, I think.
Isn't that a peninsula?
Kind of is, like Florida.
I don't even know if it's an island.
Ed Helms.
You also love a cappella.
I want to be clear, I am a cappella neutral.
And Avengers director Joe Russo.
There's a direct connection between Arrested and Community and what we did in Infinity War.
Don't miss The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner on Podcast One.
Alexa isn't the only one with breaking news. Make sure to hang around at the end of this podcast for the latest breaking headlines on the AP News Minute.
More than a year after Marlis was murdered, on September 26, 1980, Diane Edwards cleared the last of her tables and clocked out. Diane was 19 and lived in West St. Paul, Minnesota. She walked home, north on Roberts Road. She was only three blocks from her home when a brown station wagon drove over the sidewalk. An unidentified man forced Diane into the car while five people witnessed her abduction. The police were called, and a search was carried out. But there were no leads on the young waitress's whereabouts. Two weeks later, a hunter found a pair of glasses and a purse as he walked down a country road. The ID inside of the purse belonged to Diane Edwards. Chief Deputy David Hofstad, along with dozens of other police officers, began to search. Here's Chief Deputy Hofstad.
Shortly thereafter, here comes a helicopter, and I would say within 5 minutes, one of the deputies in the helicopter radioed me and said to get in my car and drive up the road to this little hill and get out of your car and walk down into the ditch. And as I walked into the ditch, I observed a female laying on her stomach.
The woman was Diane Edwards. She'd been killed by a single stab wound to the chest. Hearing the details of Diane's tragic murder, it was brought to Deputy Hofstad's attention that this case shared a lot of similarities with the Hewling murders. Then he learned that the suspect for the Hewling family murders was Joe Turry. The investigative team was able to get a warrant, and they searched Joe Turry's property for clues that he was involved in Diane's murder. Here's Deputy Hofstad again.
They found spiral notebooks with pages of names of girls.
We've already accepted that spiral notebooks with names of women is creepy, but not a crime. In Diane's case, however, her name and the number to the restaurant where she worked were in Joe Turry's notebook. Investigators believe there was a strong possibility that Turry killed Diane, so Hofstad decided to question him. Turry was incarcerated at the time, sentenced to 30 years for three counts of rape, so locating him was relatively simple. This is Deputy Hofstad again.
He played with you. I mean, I think he was good at trying to think he could manipulate you and lead you all over and not go anywhere. He never ever said anything when we talked to him up there that you could come down on, but when you walked out of there, you really had a feeling this is the right trail.
For the second time, a lack of evidence against Turry prevented the investigation from continuing. The case of Diane Edwards, joined the Hewling murders, and Marlis Wollenhouse's murder in the file of cold cases. Prison was especially difficult for a loner like Turry. Here's Deputy Archie Sonnenstahl to explain.
He was being picked on by fellow inmates. The guards were giving him a bunch of crap. Nobody liked him, he had no friends, and everybody was picking on him.
Deputy Sonnenstahl transferred Turry to a different cell block, and Turry was grateful. Here's Deputy Sonnenstahl again.
He says, I really appreciate that. He says, you're the first one that's ever did anything for me. I says, well, here's my card. If you have any further problems, give me a call.
2 weeks later, Turry used the phone from the jail to call Deputy Sonnenstahl. He felt mentally unstable and wanted to be hospitalized rather than incarcerated. He asked the man who had helped him before if he would help him again. In exchange, Turry said he'd be willing to cooperate with investigators regarding a murder. Here's Sonnenstahl again.
We got into a conversation about his cooperating with authorities. And did I feel that they would cooperate back with him if he needed some psychiatric help, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? Basically, in so many words, Joe would clean up the Diane Edwards homicide.
Deputy Sonnenstahl shared the message with the prosecutor overseeing Diane Edwards' case. The prosecutor wanted to hear what Turry had to say. This is Deputy Sonnenstahl again.
And they said, go back and talk to him and tell him that we're receptive to the idea of cooperation.
The deputy interviewed Joe Turry in May of 1981. Turry wanted to trade his cell for a hospital room, and he was willing to discuss his part in Diane's murder to make his move possible. Here's some audio from that interview.
You said you saw a gal walking up the street?
Yeah.
Did you stop by this gal?
Yeah.
Who was she?
Diane.
Diane who?
Edwards.
He pulled up alongside of her, and he recognized her, and she recognized him. And he asked her to get in the car, and she wouldn't, so he grabbed her, forced her in the car.
After you got her in the car, how did you manage to keep her in the car?
Tied a rope around her arms, back of her.
Tied a rope around her arms behind her?
Yeah.
While Diane was restrained, Turry drove 60 miles north to a rural area near Elk River. And then he raped her on the front seat. Here's more of the interview between Turry and Deputy Sonnenstahl.
Did she say something to you or do something after you finished having intercourse the first time on the front seat?
Yeah, she screamed at me and said something that I can't remember exactly.
And how did you respond to that?
Blew up.
You blew up. And when you blew up, what happened?
I stabbed her.
He said he then drug her down an inclinement down towards the woods where he raped her again. And he thought she might have been dead by that time because she wasn't moving or saying anything.
Wanting to be sure that Turry was being honest, investigators Sonnenstahl and Hofstede asked Turry to take them places that he talked about in his interview. This is Deputy Hofstede.
And he had me turn up this little trail that was, I knew led to the site, and we're coming up that little hill, and as we get to the spot, he says, stop right here.
Turry got out of the car and started to walk down an embankment. Then he pointed to a ditch.
And Dave looked at me and he said, you know, he's within 4 feet of where we found the body.
That was Deputy Sonnenstahl. And this is Deputy Hofstede.
And this is a very rural setting. So far as landmarks, I mean, they just aren't there. He knew.
On May 13th, 1981, Joe Turry was charged with the murder of Diane Edwards, a crime he was eventually convicted of committing. As he awaited trial, however, Turry discovered that despite his confession, a transfer to the state mental hospital was not going to be offered to him. Turry stayed in prison, and in December of 1981, Toby Crominga became his new cellmate. The two didn't click at first, but eventually they got friendly with each other. This is Toby Crominga.
Well, we played cards, we played checkers. He was waiting trial on Diane Edwards, and he talked a little bit about that.
Crominga then claimed that Joe Turry dictated two letters to him. The first was about the murder of a waitress named Susie Hewling. He said that he'd asked Susie out, but she told him that she couldn't because her mother didn't allow her to date. Turry then said he started to follow Susie's mother. Here's Crominga again.
We actually went over to the mother's house and told the mother he wanted to date her daughter. And she told him, call him a pervert, told him to get the hell out.
The letter went on. I grabbed her by the hair, and I told her that before she died, she would go through more physical and mental pain than she'd ever gone through in her life. He then described killing the oldest three children in great detail. In a second letter, Turry went on to describe the murder of Marlis Woolenhouse. The letter read, I freaked and hit her 3 or 4 times in the head with a hatchet. I heard the dog going crazy upstairs, so I left in a hurry. Turry signed and dated both statements. Crominga signed as a witness and handed the letters off to a jail guard to be delivered to a judge. His letters didn't make it to the judge. Instead, Terry's confession was a leading story on the local evening news.
In the Hewling murder confession, Terry says he knew one of the Hewling daughters, but her mother refused to let him see her. He planned to tie up the family and rape one of the daughters. But when he went into the house and entered Mrs. Hewling's bedroom on the main floor, she recognized him and said, and we quote, "Leave my house, you pervert." Terry then says he shot her above the knees and hit her a couple of times.
Terry and Kraminga were together during the local news broadcast. And Joe Terry was extremely angry that his letters had been leaked. Here's Toby Kraminga again.
Oh, he just freaked. He kept on saying to me, "You double-crossed me, you lied to me, the judge is supposed to get it all out, you know."
Once the letters were made public, Joe Terry denied making them. He claimed that he had signed a blank piece of paper. He thought the paper was a petition for better food. Terry goes even further by offering an alibi to investigators. He claimed he was working at the Ford production plant when Marlis was murdered. The alibi checked out, and the letters no longer looked as solid. Terry's denial of the letters, and Kraminga's claim that he had dictated them, was just one inmate's word against another. Marlis's case, and the Hewling family case, would stay cold for another 15 years. Minnesota's Bureau of Criminal Apprehension is where the coldest state case files are sent. In 1996, Special Agent Everett Doolittle and Special Agent Randy Stricker dug into the file of Marlis Wollenhouse. This is Special Agent Doolittle.
And I met with the investigators and they said, "No, we cleared him. Terry was at work at the time of the murder and couldn't have done it." And that's been said all along.
The cold case detectives were not satisfied with the verbal confirmation. They asked Ford to locate the actual time card for the day in question. Later, one of Doolittle's detectives called him with the results from the search.
And he said, "Yeah, Joe Turry was at work on May 8th at the time of the murder." Joe Turry, date of birth, 1911, was. And I said, he said, "Yes, his dad was at work at the time. There's no record showing Joe Turry was at work."
That was Special Agent Doolittle. It was starting to look like Joe Turry Sr. had been at work, but his son, the Joe Turry in question, hadn't. This is Special Agent Stricker.
Going back and rechecking, identified that they were both employed there and that Joe was working the later shift, which afforded him the opportunity to commit the crime and still make it to work on time. So that was the big break. It blew away his alibi.
Because the alibi that invalidated the letters was unconfirmed, the investigators re-examined them for clues or mistakes. Here's Special Agent Doolittle again.
We took it apart, piece by piece by piece. What he said he did, where he went. And then there were little things in there. And one of the little things, they didn't seem to be matter that much, but they mean everything.
On the third page of the letter confessing to Marlis's murder, the investigators discover a story that might be one of those little things that matter. It's a story about a little girl. Here's Stricker and Doolittle to explain.
He talked about coming out the end of the driveway and spinning his tires and blowing gravel all over this girl.
His quote, "I see this little bitch and I put it to the floor, I spin gravel and I take off." And there's a statement from a girl who was 8 years old at the time, who got out of school, is walking to her girlfriend's house. And she's walking right by the entrance to the long driveway. And she's interviewed back then and said, "I saw this," she called it a cream-colored little car, "come out and this guy threw gravel and dust all over her and took off." That's never been in the media. That's never been out because they're really worried about she's 8 years old. The family was scared for her safety.
In this business, you'll have people confess to crimes that they didn't commit, but they don't know the particulars. Joe knew the particulars.
There's information in there that nobody would ever know and couldn't know but the person who committed the murder.
Joe Terry was being investigated a third time for Marlis's murder, 17 years after the crime was committed. This time, it stuck. In 1996, Terry was finally arrested and charged with the young woman's murder. On October 14th, 1998, Terry was convicted of the murder of Marlis Wollenhouse. But the case doesn't end here. John Fristick from the Washington County Attorney's Office in Minnesota was the prosecutor on Marlis's case. Fristic had done some research on Turi to prepare for the trial and discovered that he was under suspicion for the murder of the Hewling family. Fristic reviewed the documents from the Hewling family murders investigation. He looked at the inventory recovered from the stolen car driven by Turi. A metal bar, a list of women's names, and a toy Batmobile. At the time, no link was developed between these items and the Hewling murders. 19 years later, John Fristic believed he had found a connection. This is Assistant County Attorney Fristic.
And I thought to myself, what is Joe Turi doing with a Batmobile in his car? Everything else in the car I can understand somewhat. What is he doing with a child's toy, a little tiny Batmobile? And then it occurred to me, Alice Hewling had two small sons, Billy and Wayne, the same age as boys who would play with toy Batmobiles. And so I thought to myself, where did he get this car? Did this come from the Hewling house?
There was one person who might be able to answer those questions. The sole survivor and witness to the killings. This is Billy Hewling.
Being as young as I was, I didn't want to talk about it. I didn't want to do anything. And I just wanted to continue on with my life and forget that it ever happened. But it's something that you never really forget. And as you grow older, you start thinking about it more. You know, it hits you and you're like, man, you know, my family's not here. The witness coordinator in Washington County called up and said that they had some evidence that they wanted me to look at. And just, I don't know why I said it or how or where it ever came from. It's just like, oh, did you find my Batmobile car?
The next day, Billy positively identified his toy, a toy found in the car of Joe Turi, 4 days after the murders. Here's John Fristic again.
Joe Turi took from their house after he killed Alice Hewling and her children. He took from their house Billy Hewling's Batmobile. He took a souvenir.
Special Agent Stricker opened the cold Hewling family case file and looked at the autopsy photos of Alice Hewling. He noticed an unusual pattern of bruising. This is Special Agent Stricker again.
In reading the reports that have been generated by the officers that were conducting the investigation, they had indicated that the bruise on the body could have been caused by a shotgun butt or a shotgun barrel, and I couldn't see the correlation there.
Stricker brought in an expert, a bruise expert, to help him determine the cause of this particular pattern. Here's Dr. Michael McGee.
She had a bruise that was elongated. It looked like it almost had a cylindrical or tubular appearance. The bruise has a distinct upper border and lower border, and in the midst of it are small punctate areas of hemorrhage, suggesting to me that whatever object had struck her was long, probably metal, had a rounded edge, and had a series of circular to oval-shaped depressions cut into it. At least that's what I told the BCA they should be looking for.
Based on the description from Dr. McGee, Stricker wanted to look at that metal pipe pulled from the stolen car. He was able to locate it and shared it with the expert. Here's Dr. McGee again.
They left it for me to look at. I measured it, compared it to the autopsy photos, compared it to the autopsy measurements, and based on that, I told them, I think this is it. So you can see the edge of the bar matches the edge here. The edge of the bar matches the edge here. The small holes present in the surface of the wrapping match the small focal areas of bruising and abrasion on the surface of the body. The strap in the middle of the bar that holds the wrapping in place can be seen as this blanch mark running down the course. So when the bar impacted the body, it imprinted this pattern of the bar strap and the holes on the body, causing a reverse image.
Dr. McGee's testimony was the final link in the chain of evidence the investigators had been building. In 2000, 2 years after his conviction for Marlis's murder, a jury found Turi guilty of 4 counts of murder. It took the jury less than 12 hours to deliberate. Turi was sentenced to another 4 consecutive life sentences. Turi's actions hurt so many people. The victims paid the ultimate price, but those who lost a family member, or their entire family, also suffered. There's not a right way to deal with trauma. Billy Hewling accepted the judgment and sentence, but he felt no relief.
I'm at a point now where it doesn't matter. It's not going to change anything. He's doing his time in jail. He's never going to get out. I'm happy with that. I can live with that. 20 years ago, no, that probably wouldn't be enough.
Billy's perspective might be hard to hear, but he's not wrong. Justice can't be fully achieved after a murder, because no sentence will bring back the victim to their loved ones. For Fran Wollenhaus, at least, Turi's sentence lifted the weight of uncertainty she had lived with for so many years. She was no longer a mother hoping to help her daughter one last time. She was free.
For us, we went for so many years without knowing who killed Marlis. And I say it was like a freeing of my soul when I finally had answers.
Cold Case Files is hosted by Brooke Giddings, produced by McKamey Lynn and Steve Delamater. Our executive producer is Ted Butler. We're distributed by Podcast One. Cold Case Files Classic was produced by Curtis Productions and hosted by the one and only Bill Curtis. Check out more Cold Case Files at aetv.com or learn about more cases like this one by visiting the A&E Real Crime blog at aetv.com/realcrime.
Get ultimate protection and durability for your painting project at Menards. Get a paint that combines durability and gorgeous color. Dutch Boy's DuraClean Interior Paint and Primer in 1 offers Stay Clean technology, making your home stay beautiful and clean longer. And with Dutch Boy's easy opening, smooth pouring container, transforming your home has never been easier. Save big money on Dutch Boy paints and head into Menards to get your paint project started today. Save big.